Accession number 26868, Reel 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Max Gamble in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 9th of the 1st, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Max, you were telling us about the time you were shot from underneath. Luckily you got out of that. You wanted to add some other things before you moved on.
Well, it was about this time we've got to now where I was made the senior flight commander on the squadron and also was put in charge of flying operations to relieve the CO of that, and he was able to concentrate on other things. Just on the aircraft, the Mustang's speed, there's an interesting thing that I had been leading a flight of four aircraft to bombing in Yugoslavia in the southern part down towards Greece, and I received a radio message to go to the force landing field Zara to pick up an RAF Spitfire and his pilot, because he'd force landed there because he couldn't find his way home, which was terrible. All he had to do was cross the sea for half an hour or so and get onto the coast. Anyway, I objected, but I was told get on with it, so I landed with the three other aircraft at Zara. Found this chap who turned out to be one of these Knowles, and in the end I got so frustrated I was giving him a hell of a bollocking, and left him in no doubt about what I thought of his whole flying operations. At this time there was somebody came up behind me and said, "Having trouble, Gamble?" And I said, "Am I having trouble?" "Oh, hello, sir." And it was Air Marshal George Mills, who'd been flying at the time, and he'd heard these messages, and I think he agreed with me about this chap. He was in fits of laughter, and he said, "Right, I'll clear off. You've got the situation well in hand." But then told this sergeant he was to fly which side, and that I'd throttle back so that he could keep up. "Well," he said, "he was flying a Spitfire, and there was nothing would pass that." So I didn't say anything. I just took off. And he formated all right. And I just gave it the normal cruise. The way we went, I knew exactly what was going to happen. Before long, there was a wild squeak, "Please throttle back. I'm at full throttle and I can't keep up." So that just shows the speed of the Mustang in comparison. So I had to throttle back, and I took him to the coast and then told him to head north up, northwest up the coast, and he'd find his aerodrome. I put that in just to show the difference. Mm. Now, we were talking before about strafing, and I omitted to give a couple of details. The gun sight we had was an image which was projected onto a glass screen in front of the pilot, so that if you moved that way or that way, it moved with you. So you had the dot and the circle. And the greatest thing with this was that you used it using both eyes. You never closed an eye, because that was difficult from the perspective of distance. And I'll give you an example. We had bombed in Yugoslavia, more or less the central area, and looking for targets, and we found a group of armoured vehicles. So we started to strafe these, and normally you didn't all go in at once, as you can imagine. I came in, shot as many as I could, went round, and then the other three people did it in turn, and I was coming up behind the last one, I suppose about 500 metres behind. And suddenly, he went straight into the target, and I had to do a bit of evasive action because of a Merlin engine flying through the air. Now, this chap had been told and told and told, you never close one eye. Obviously, what he'd done was close an eye. He didn't get the distance correct, so he went through the target. I had another sort of odd thing on the Termoli airstrip. We'd been out bombing, came back. We used to land fairly quickly in fairly close succession. But we also were sharing the airfield with some marauders, and this squadron were terrible at dallying on the strip. So I landed, my number two came in behind me, and suddenly I could see that the marauders, instead of going off the strip, had turned round on the strip and were blocking it. So I started braking. My number two behind me didn't see this. He was suffering a little bit from finger trouble. I tried to call him up, but I couldn't. We had a rather bad aerodrome controller who loved talking all the time, and when he was talking, you couldn't get in. So in the rear vision mirror, I could see him coming straight up the back of my aircraft. Well, there was one thing, I had to get out of the way. So I did almost a right angle turn to the left of the runway and then a right angle turn to the right to try and stay there. And he sailed past. I could see the horror on his thing, but I slid sideways and one wheel went off and into the sand. And it was pretty well bogged, so I thought, well, I'm not going to stay here. So I took a chance on a tipping, because if you used a hell of a lot of throttle, the pull on the top was inclined to turn the aircraft up and let it tip on its nose. Well, I took a bit of a chance, and with using a lot of throttle, it eventually lifted itself out of there, and I came in. But I'd been having a few arguments with the wing commander from the wing. So he promptly put me on a court-martial charge for this, which was quite ridiculous, because if I'd stayed where I was, my aircraft would have been gone, I'd have been gone, and the other aircraft would have been gone as well. So when I was told about this, all I did was telephone the group captain and told him. He knew about the incident. Well, he was very unimpressed with the wing commander and told him to dry up. I mention this because it comes up again. Mm. And again, in the same period, I had to be the escort with one other aircraft to Field Marshal Alexander, to Belgrade, because the Russians only used 87-octane fuel. We couldn't get any fuel there, so we had to have long-range tanks on to get to Belgrade and back. Well, we got to Belgrade and had a week's wait while the Field Marshal went through his discussions with the Russians, and the temperature was sub-zero. Every day I ran that two aircraft, because we only had a small battery about this big with a 27-litre engine. And to keep the battery up, well, that worked fine until the day we were leaving. And the battery in my aircraft went a bit funny. In fact, he wouldn't turn the prop at all. So there it was. The other chap had to carry on as escort to the field marshal. I raced around, got a series of batteries. Remember, there was a language problem because there was Yugoslavs and Russians. I stacked up batteries to get me about 1.5 times the normal voltage, and 2 bare wires, and I set the handbrake and the throttle and primed it and got outside on the 2 prongs that are closed over. I just like that, and the engine went like that and burst into life. So then I took off as soon as I could after that, and that's when I took that photograph I've shown you there. And then I caught up with the field marshal.
You'd shown me a picture that you took of Belgrade, am I right? Could you describe to us what we were to see and why you were taking that particular picture?
That was purely of interest. There was no main reason. I just had this opportunity, as I had to take off over the city like this from the field, so I thought I'd take a picture on.
Can you explain to us how the camera was rigged in?
The camera was put in, the landing light was taken out and the camera was put in there. So then in the plane there were 2 cameras. There was this still camera in the landing light, and there was another camera which operated, a cine camera, operated when the guns were fired, and was aimed on the same trajectory as the guns. The main reason for this was early in the war, there were people claiming aircraft shot down, when in fact they were nowhere near. And so to stop that and to get better information, the cine cameras were put in.
Why would people say that if that hadn't happened?
For their own aggrandizement, purely. And to beat the Joe Blow with the number of aircraft they'd got down. Anyway, whilst we were in Belgrade, first of all, we didn't have going in single-seater aircraft with no space around. We didn't have the right clothing, so we were shivering a bit. And we had no money that they would take there. So I said to the other chaps, right, I'll pay for this, I'll open my escape kit, which was, if you opened it without due cause, it was a court-martial offence. Well, I opened it and got the money out, and when we had to go out and occasionally entertain the old Russian, I used that money. We got, a full-course meal with some wine with it. And the conversion of the American dollars cost about 10 cents. Anyway, when we got back, I told the group captain that I'd done this because we had no money. And he said, well, that's perfectly all right. The same wing commander I was telling you about before, when he heard about that, he immediately put another court-martial thing on my head.
What did a court-martial mean in that respect?
To go on trial, and if you were found guilty, you'd probably thrown out or stuffed in the brig or whatever.
But how long would you be stuffed in the brig for something like that, do you think?
No idea. Depended entirely on how the people on the court-martial viewed it. Anyway, I just telephoned the group captain again, and he created quite a noise over this one and told this fellow to dry up, otherwise he'd have him discharged. So that was it.
What was the problem with this?
He didn't like me because the group captain used to come up to the mess and have drinks with me about every 2 or 3 days. And he was sort of jealous of that. So I was the bad boy. He was looking to even. And there was nothing to even.
I'm interested that you've mentioned that people would compete with one another and try and get a better score. And to what degree was there this sort of competition going on all the time?
Generally, there was a little bit of healthy competition, that nasty type of competition. You came across fairly rarely, but it gave the squadron, the wing or whatever, a bad name when it did occur, if it was discovered.
You're mentioning that you had been given the position of the flight commander?
I was the senior flight commander on the squadron. There were two flight commanders.
What did that job entail for you, that position?
Well, when I was in charge of flying, I was the one who received the flight orders for the next day, the briefing for the next day, from whoever the might be that person giving it, might be the group captain, might be somebody else, and so on. And then I was the one who decided who would fly which aircraft and so on. At this time, a number of the pilots had been my pupils at the operational training unit, and so I had a pretty good rapport with all of them. On that, one of the chaps, one day when we were flying and had bombed, he started to call me up, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying. And I just couldn't work out what it was. So I said, right, to the chap who was flying nearest to me, to move out and for him to come in close so I could have a look at him. So then I took him to, told him to take his microphone and an oxygen mask off, because I could see a hole through the canopy. And there was his lip hanging down there. The bullet had gone straight through. It had gone through, cut his lip off so it was hanging on one side, and took all his front teeth out. So then I realised why he couldn't talk very well. So I told the other people to get a little bit out of the way and told him just to full mate on me. And when we came in, I took him round, talking to him all the way and giving him the speed, and I more or less did a sort of false landing alongside him, but didn't go down because there was no runway there, and got him landed that way. He went off to the hospital. I can't remember where he went to, but he came back to us, and all he had was a little line along there. His face was a bit puckered, but or tight. But he came back and joined us again.
The situation that you've mentioned previously of not really taking too seriously the dangers of flying, presumably one of the dreaded things was you would get maimed severely as opposed to being killed.
That's right.
What were the biggest fears in regard to that?
I don't really know. I can't remember just how I felt about it then. But you're quite right, it was the thing at the back of your mind. The other thing at the back of the mind was, well, if you'd had lots and lots of near misses, which you were having virtually every day, you knew that one day you'd be unlucky. That sooner or later, you probably wouldn't be with it.
People obviously talk of witnessing people being burnt. And we see and hear stories of people that were severely burned in aircraft because they weren't able to get out in time. Or... Did you experience anything like that?
I saw it happen too many times. I wasn't actually involved, thank God. And the awkward thing with that was that it wasn't enemy action.
What do you mean?
It was either the undercarriage not locking down so that the thing eventually, the cannon stuck into the ground, it somersaulted, petrol spilled and went on fire. And everything was so quick there was no time for the pilot to get out because he was trapped underneath. The other one was the same sort of thing happened when the rather rubbishy tyres on the Spitfire occasionally burst on landing. But that's going back to the previous squadron.
How did mistakes like that affect the crew, affect the squadron?
You'd got to the stage where you accepted these sort of things were going to happen and would continue to happen. So that you just, somewhere or other, you blotted it out. That's what happened most of the time.
People talk of the general situation, putting things at the back of their mind. Did you, when you weren't flying, how did you entertain yourselves? Was that sort of directed towards taking your mind off as well? Party hard, play hard, party hard, fly hard, party hard?
Oh, we used to have the odd sort of booze up in the mess and so on. And I think most of the drinks I had were with the group captain because he loved coming up and a lot of the time one spent on getting around with the ground staff, seeing what was going on, harmonising the guns, general activity, also at times certain places trying to get extra food for the mess. We could raise the money, but the thing was getting the food. And then there was also discussing with the various pilots various things to improve the whole discipline of the squadron. We had on this squadron a very, very strict discipline when we were flying, and silence as much as possible. The discipline was laxed when we're on the ground. Every now and then the sergeants would race up to the mess and grab me and take me down there, and I'd have a lot of trouble getting out of that mess in an hour or two.
The rules of flying, if you've been drinking?
Oh, you never touched it. That was very strict. And you made certain that if you were flying the next day, you watched how much you had to drink. And if you didn't do it, somebody else would take over. I had an odd occurrence in the previous squadron where this chap, a Canadian, he got himself in a party with some people not in the squadron, but they were visitors to the squadron, and they were doing this Cardinal Puff, which meant every sort of drink went into this tankards of alcohol. I grabbed him and said, "Look, you're flying tomorrow early." He said, "I got into this and I can't get out." I said, "Okay, I'll take over your shocking ruddy drink and take your place because I'm not flying tomorrow. Well, I did, but I paid for it. He unfortunately was shot down and killed about a week later. So that alcohol did not come into it. One occasion perhaps only where this chap I'm flying over Yugoslavia, he suddenly started to scream out that he was in terrible pain and so on. And what it actually was about 2 days previously he had lots and lots to drink and so on, and he had a stomach cramp. But it wasn't as though he was under the influence, it was the after effect sometime later. I also had trouble with a bite that I got in Yugoslavia, probably when I went to pick up this Spitfire pilot. On the arm here, I had a poisoned arm, and that took me off flying for about a week. They cured it with 693, the initial penicillin thing, which had after effects that it upset your vision. And I was not supposed to fly for some period. But somehow or other, the people who went out, they could not find one German division, which had just disappeared. I thought, well, this is just, can't be. So even though I was supposed not to be flying, I got my number two. And we didn't put bombs on, we just went to try and find this so that our activities could be directed against it the following days. And we took off in the middle of the afternoon and thought they might think there's no planes going to be around and we would pick them up. Well, we did pick them up in a ruddy valley and they're all close together. Well, we had a bit of a slaughter of the vehicles there. We left about 50, 60 vehicles on fire and so on, just the two of us with the guns. And having got them, well, then the next day's bombing was directed against this area.
The situation where you're, as I've asked before, the situation when you're in this position of power and people on the ground are fairly well defenceless, how does the isolation make the job easier?
In what way?
Because you're not close to the ground and you're not actually experiencing what your guns are doing. How does being...
Well, with strafing you were, because you could see what was happening. You could see a truck blow up because of the petrol and the armour-piercing incendiary bullets being used. You could see German officers leaping like this to get out of the way of a stream of bullets and so on, leaping into filthy water and so on. So that you did. It was... Bombing was a little bit separate, but strafing was getting a little bit close and a little bit personal. Mind you, they had their guns were firing back.
At the end of the day, did you ever sort of sit down and say, oh, what I did today, and there'll be families in Germany, you know, not...
No, I think people were so fed up with the atrocities of the Nazis that you had no regrets. I think the best shot I ever did was one day coming back from bombing and then strafing. We're flying along with a high, right alongside high tension wires, big ones, you know, 6, 666,000 volt things. And I saw one of these dreaded, or said, saw four of these dreaded brown shirts, or Gestapo really, in the German equivalent of the Jeep, open Jeep. And there was no time to let, I just told the squadron, keep flying straight and I'll catch up. And I went under the power lines, caught this vehicle on a corner. I only had time to do that to the gun switching off because I was heading into the ground. Turned, and I suppose it was second and a half or so that I could turn, I could see over the side of the plane. And there was a very odd sight with a Jeep going straight down the road, four brown shirts sitting in it, and the flames enveloping the whole lot of them. And they, the stories about them were such that one didn't have any pity.